pay attention to the things that government could and should do. The important thing was to realize how little government could do, and what a remarkable mechanism there was at work that took care of organizing cooperation even though nobody was specifically concerned about it. Well, now, economics and capitalism developed together, the science of economics and the capitalist system. Economics originated as a discipline or a science in the recognition that there is an order, they like to call it a natural order, to economic events under competitive conditions. That if you've got competition, which means private property and minimal state intervention, you are going to get a kind of a predictable order in economic affairs. And economics developed as the science which spells out carefully the logic of this order. Economists after Adam Smith for the next century and a half spent most of their time trying to show what happened in general in competitive economic systems, or as it turned out, in capitalistic economic systems. So that the accusation that traditional economic theory and capitalism have enjoyed an incestuous relationship is true to a large extent. Capitalism developed concurrently with economics, and traditional economics was designed to analyze the workings of a basically capitalist economy. But now, the economists after Smith they ignored or minimized the importance of or asserted the inevitability of certain problems, and that led to criticism. Let me just give an example. I said ignore, minimize, assert the inevitability. One of the problems that they ignored completely, they just weren't interested, they didn't talk about it, was the problem of development, of the transformation of economic institutions, or the economic history. They just weren't interested in it. But you see, this is a very important problem for lots of people in the 19th century and for lots of people today. They were really talking about, they were enunciating universal economic laws applicable to England. But the problem for lots of countries was, how do you get to be like England? How did England get there? Sure, this Smith described very well in Ricardo and Mill and Marshall the operation of market economies, but how many were there in the world? 2, 3, 4? And it's great, it did provide beautifully, it raised the wealth of a nation. But for most countries, this wasn't a live option. How could other countries come to England's enviable position? The economists didn't talk about this. Economic analysis was static. It just assumed a given state of affairs and explained how that worked out. It wasn't dynamic. It didn't show how, well, it didn't concern itself with economic history. I'll just leave it that way. Showed how a market economy worked, but not how it got to be a market economy in the first place. An example of the problem whose importance they minimized was the problem of recurring crises with their attendant unemployment. Until the 1930s, economists, they didn't assert that depressions were impossible, but they said they come, they're temporary, and the best thing to do is just wait and they will go away. In fact, if you try to do something about them, you're more likely to make the problem worse. Well, that made a lot of people unhappy. I mean, if you're unemployed and you're told, now just wait, this unemployment is a temporary phenomenon, and in 2 years you'll have a job again. And then, as for inevitability, a lot of people, of course, in the 19th century and in the 20th have been concerned about inequality. And the classical economists just felt, well, gee, inequality is inevitable. Why? Because there is natural inequality in human endowment. We do not all have the same abilities and energy and everything else. Now, if you try to somehow overcome this natural inequality by giving equality of income, you're just going to interfere with the whole economic system. You're going to destroy the whole system of incentives. You've got to reward people basically according to their contribution. If you try to, you can interfere a little bit. People like John Stuart Mill were interested in a little bit of the welfare state, but Mill, who has a reputation for being a utopian socialist, really, if you read him, you find that there was very little that he was willing to allow. Not on principle, not because he believed in some philosophical system, but as an economist, Mill just predicted that if you started taking from the rich and giving to the poor, you would so interfere with the whole productive and distributive system that you would level out all right, but you'd level down. Everybody would become as poor as the poorest. You wouldn't pull down the rich and raise up the poor. So they just said, the poor ye have always with you. And that's it here. Most unfortunate. They often wrung their hands about it. And Alfred Marshall, one of the great economists at the turn of the century in England, talked about how he walked through the slums of London and saw the poor and was determined that he would go into economics in order to do a little teeny bit to alleviate their lot, knowing that, of course, inevitably, poverty is the lot of most men. Well, now, nobody saw these shortcomings more clearly than our next hero, who was Karl Marx. You may wonder why I'm getting into history. You'll see in a moment. Karl Marx, in the beginning about the middle of the 19th century, fashioned an enormous and extremely wordy engine of analysis, which was designed not so much to replace, but to supplement bourgeois economics. Marx's economics has certain characteristics that I want to stress. In the first place, it is a dynamic, evolutionary system of analysis. Marx was out, as he put it, to show the law of motion of capitalism, to explain how capitalism evolves, its maturation, its contradictions, its dissolution, and its ultimate replacement by another system. Marx took the given orthodox static analysis of the classical economists for granted. He assumed it was right, except in a few minor respects. He took this for granted, and he went on now to show how economic systems changed over time and how an economic system was a part of a political and a social system. Marx was the first great evolutionary thinker in economics, perhaps first great evolutionary thinker in social science. A second thing you want to know about Marx. Marx does not even begin to blueprint the next stage. He never mentions it casually, but he does not discuss socialism, what it will look like. Marx is an analyst of capitalism. Of course, his big three-volume major work is called Das Kapital, not Das Sozial or anything. Marx was interested in how capitalism works, but he steadfastly refused to prescribe the coming socialist order. For very good reasons. Marx said, history will tell us what it will look like. When we get there, then we'll know. And anybody who tried to write blueprints for the future, Marx scornfully rejected as a utopian socialist. Marx was a scientific socialist. He read the laws of history and he showed how inevitably one society evolves out of another. And if you want to know what tomorrow's society will look like, read history and predict from history, or wait until it comes. Don't go writing any silly blueprints by organizing committees. Third thing, Marx's whole system levels a massive moral indictment against capitalism. Now, this is quite inconsistent, really, because Marx has got two sides of Marx. Marx can speak glowingly about capitalism and the capitalist and the tremendous accomplishments of capitalism and the capitalist. And he said, capitalists can't help it. Don't scorn the poor man. He can't help it. He's just an engine of the historical process. He's got to do what he's got to do. But at the same time, there is this Jewish prophet in Marx. And he's indignantly, he can get so sarcastic and bitter. And this is the element in Marx. It's quite inconsistent with his professed attitude of scientific detachment. This is the note in Marx which accounts for most of his popularity. This is about all that people read in Marx. Very few people sit down and go through the Das Kapital, but everybody is familiar with the clashing cymbals and the mighty crescendo of the closing part of Volume 1, where he talks, in one paragraph he says the big capitalists get bigger and the little capitalists disappear into the ranks of the proletariat, and the integument of capitalist society bursts asunder, the death knell of capitalism sounds, the expropriator is expropriated. You get all excited. After wading through page after page of statistics on wages and hours and conditions of work for women in Manchester textile mills, it's the moral philosopher, not the scientist, that has captured the imagination of people in the last century. Fourthly, Marx traces the perceived failures of capitalism, and everybody was perceiving failures in capitalism, he traces them to internal contradictions of a given phase of historical development. In other words, he says, see, we just passed through this period, but there is hope and there is a promise. History will bring us out. So do not despair. Look to the future. Salvation cometh, history will deliver us. Now these are, I think, the major elements in Marx's thought that you want to keep in mind, his dynamic evolutionary analysis, seeing all of society and the whole economic system is changing and changing inevitably. A refusal to talk about socialism, what it's going to look like. A great moral indignation against capitalism, and plus hope and promise. You know, even though you don't know what socialism will look like, though we do not know what the kingdom of God will look like, we know that it comes. And we are a part of it, because our hearts are pure since we are proletarian. If I try to make this sound theological, that's deliberate. It's a very excellent little book, quite old now, but, well, quite old, 15 years old, by Alexander Miller. Christian Significance of Karl Marx. It shows some parallels between Marx and Christian doctrine. It shows that Marx was Marxism was a kind of Christian heresy. Well, now, we come to modern socialism. It's a long digression. I think it's best to know something about Marx so that you can get a perspective on modern socialism. There are, I submit, four major types of modern socialism. And classify them with relation to Marx. The first two turn out to be unimportant. There is, first of all, the pure Marxist. You can hardly find one around. The best one I've seen is now the almost completely defunct Socialist Labor Party in the United States. Daniel De Leon was one of their great leaders. There's some gal, Cozzini. What's her name? She runs perennially for president of the United States or vice president on the Socialist Labor Party. I can't think of her first name. This is not Norman Thomas's party, but the Socialist Labor Party, which is good orthodox Marxist. I mean, that's pure Marxist. But they're quite irrelevant to everything. Then there is the Marxist updated group of socialists. They accept Marx as very authoritative, but they don't accept verbal inspiration. So they will correct him here and there. They add a theory of monopoly capitalism. Say Marx was talking about competitive capitalism. The capitalism has evolved since his time into monopoly capitalism. And they accept a few corrections to Marx's predictions too, since some of them didn't work out too well. But this group, though it includes many very brilliant men, is pretty much confined to academic circles. You find people writing and teaching who are this kind of updated Marxist. But this kind of Marxism has no, or socialism, has no real strong roots in any country. It's an interesting intellectual pastime. My friend Paul Swayze is an example of this kind. Now, then there's the revisionist explicit, and finally the revisionist implicit, and these are the two types I'm interested in. The explicit revisionist. That is, the guy who says, Marx was a great man. Sort of, Jesus was a great man type. You know what's coming now. or St. Paul had some interesting insights. This would include the Fabians of all sorts. The European socialist parties, the American socialists, George Bernard Shaw, the Christian socialists. People who say, they read Marx occasionally, or of course very selectively, they read him for edification and because he was basically on their side. But they take what is true out of Marx and ignore what is untrue. And what is true turns out to be little more than moral indignation and a little of his terminology. Politically, now this kind of socialism, which is, I think, Marxist only in name, is very influential. Marx, if he were alive today, would call it utopian. And I think he would scorn it indignantly. It's not scientific, but it's very influential. Then there is the revisionist implicit.
Excuse me, Helen, yeah. You say the British Labour Party is pretty much influenced by this group, some of these that are and generally our own in our Lutheran world, most of our Lutheran governments are.
I mean, in just a moment I'm going to raise a question, who fits where? You know, I would suggest that almost all socialist countries can be fit somewhere or the other in this two category.
Generally, that sort of social democracy group that are all our movement ideas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to characterize them more specifically in just a minute. But now, the revisionist implicit are the people who can't admit, for doctrinal reasons, that their doctrines have erred. People who cannot admit for doctrinal reasons that they have altered the dogma of Marx. This would include, you know, the what we call the communists, the Leninist, Stalinist, Khrushchev continuum, the Lenin-Tito continuum, which is quite different tradition, but still, Tito too refuses to admit that he's altered the syllable of Marx. The Lenin-Mao tradition, that's another one. But all of these people, they all say, Marx, it's in Marx. It's frightening to read articles in Soviet journals and just see how these intelligent, competent economists and engineers even really quote Marx. They use Marx as if he can solve a problem in modern engineering. I recently bought, and we passed around the quotation. Have you seen the quotation from Chairman Mao? The little book?
Yeah.
I've got a copy of that, and it's in a little red book. It looks like a book of Psalms. And you read it, and just, golly, it's terrible, you know, the worst kind of platitudes. And people are actually using
but
these.
They do, yeah, I mean, yeah. It's just a sort of, I thought it was sort of like Batman of the intellectual camp.
Well, I think that's what it is in the U.S., I'm yeah. sure.
But in China, they really use them to play ping pong, and they want to win.
They actually take it seriously, you know. In our I can't imagine any speaking more taking it seriously because it's so dull.
It's terribly awful.
Mad Magazine makes fun of it, and New Yorker makes fun of it, so I should hope that they're making fun of it and not taking it seriously. It's so old.
Well, sure, it's the in thing to have, that's why I bought one. but you can't believe how incredibly inane these quotations are. You know, just page up, you think there'll be some gems here, but here's something he says from Chairman Mao's report to the army. A good soldier struggles and works hard and fights for all the people, and he is concerned to be both theoretical and practical. You know, and you're supposed to read that for Well, these people, what I'm calling the implicit revisionists, are the grossest heretics because their Marxism, or their socialism, insofar as it is Marxist, ain't Marxist at all. He is venerated by them, but he is really ignored. It's a very selective proof passage type of Marxism. These countries are predominantly non-industrialized, and no non-industrialized country has any business being socialist if it takes Marx seriously. But as Lenin said, what can you do? I mean, you all of a sudden you find yourself with you're a socialist, you're a Marxist, you're in charge, and you history came a little too soon. Now, these last two types are the politically important forms of socialism today. And by oversimplifying a little bit, I think we can develop them into two main types of socialism. C and D, and I talk about them as C and D. Let me set it up in columns and you can contrast. Now, what I'm saying is the sort of Fabian countries, the revisionist.
Could you say who Fabius was?
Fabian was a Roman general who got a reputation for being a delayer. Fabian Cunctator, he was called. He defeated Hannibal by never fighting him. Every time Hannibal dropped his troops, Fabian would back off. Hannibal just kept chasing him up and down Italy until Hannibal was worn out and went back to Carthage. And so a group of the socialists, and George Bernard Shaw, Sidney and Beatrice Webb, and maybe Englishmen, they were very interested in socialism. They'd read Marx, but Marx was talking about revolution. He was a bearded sort of guy on that, and we don't want that. We're gentlemen first of all, and socialism will come slowly. We'll delay. We'll sneak up. Norman Thomas is a beautiful example of a Fabian socialist. They're very fine people. I think they're occasionally a little woolly-headed, but they're fine people.
Mm-hmm. You wouldn't include any of the Democratic Party?
Yes, I would, sure. There's a heavy, Fabian Socialism is heavily influenced in the Democratic Party.
The countries that have gone this route tend to be characterized by parliamentary democracy. The countries that are implicit Marxist revisionists are characterized usually by a non-liberal political tradition. Socialism in these countries is evolutionary. The attitude of the people who make policy is evolutionary. Whereas these traditions are very revolutionary, they're full of slogans. Overthrow the capitalist pig, things like that. The great vision here is the vision of the welfare state, I think. The vision over here is state ownership. And this is what they're working on, of means of production. I shouldn't call it the great vision. The great vision, of course, is the good society, or whatever. But in these countries, they concentrate on state ownership and means of production. Here they just want the welfare state. And these kind of say, well, state ownership may be good, maybe bad, we don't know. We just want lots of welfare. This kind of socialist is pragmatic, and this kind of socialist highly ideological. As Khrushchev once said in an interview with an American economist pointed out that, well, Khrushchev was talking about their problem in agriculture, problem Russians have never succeeded in solving. He said, you know, about 1% of your land is in private plots, and it produces close to 50% of your poultry, butter, eggs, meat products. Well, this has obviously worked. Why don't you let farmers have some more private plots? And Khrushchev said, not everything which works is politically correct. Right. There's the answer. Well, you need to think of the church, the fundraising problem. Sure, if we hire a fundraiser, we'll raise lots of money, and we'll have lots of money, and we can do things we want, but that's wrong. We've got to use Christian means to raise money. Whatever Christian means to raise money. The stress here is on equality, where the stress here is on growth. These countries finally have heavy dose, much market organization, whereas these countries have poorly developed market institutions. And suspicion, a great deal of suspicion of the market, and heavy reliance on the command technique. Well, now, I just find that I can look at the countries in the world that are what we call socialist, and pretty much put them in one of these two categories. Now, the best example, these are the Western European countries. England, France, to some extent, the Scandinavian countries. Over here you have the Soviet bloc countries, but a lot of other countries too. These are the so-called communist countries pretty well, and these are the so-called socialist non-communist. That's what we call them. I'm not sure what we mean by that. But now, what of a country like India? Is India socialist? I would say it is. Why? That's a good question. Is Spain socialist?
Fascist.
Yeah, I knew you'd say that. What is it? What is a fascist economic system?
Might have said that you're wrong.
I know. Well, a lot of people do say this. Spain is not socialist, Spain is fascist. Well, what is a fascist economic system? I don't know. Well, I don't think Spain should be called socialist because, one, the ideology is missing. As I suggested before, socialism is probably more a matter of ideology, even the language you use, the rhetoric you use, than anything else. You're a socialist because of the way you talk, mostly. And Spain doesn't talk socialist. In addition, in Spain, you have a lot of private ownership of industry with heavy state control.
Actually, wouldn't you call almost feudal states that have survived in a peculiar way, both Spain and Portugal again? And I was back in Portugal again and just, you know, amazed at how you can't leave the country, you know. Like Madeira, nobody's allowed to leave because new industry may come in and eat cheap labor. And then complete control. You're bound to the place where you were born.
Well, some people have chosen to call it authoritarian capitalism. I don't know. They put fascist Germany and Italy in that group. And maybe you could put a lot of Latin American countries in that group.
I was going to say almost all Latin America.
Yeah. You wouldn't want to call them socialists, though they're sometimes socialist. They're kind of, I guess the basic thing to say about a lot of Latin American countries is that they have no government, no economy. I mean, really, they're so amorphous. What about the United Arab Republic? Well, let me go back to India. What about India? We see India, non-industrialized, poor, but it had a sort of parliamentary democracy, but it's drifting this way. And the Indian attitude was evolutionary, but it's becoming more revolutionary. India started out talking about the welfare state, it was going towards state ownership, although they've stopped. Now they've decided it doesn't work too well. It's hard to say where they're going. They're still somewhat pragmatic, but they're very growth-oriented. They have, in most of the Indian economy, very poorly developed market institutions and really suspicion of the market, but at the same time in India, in some sectors, you have a lot of market organization. Where would you put the United Arab Republic? I would put it clearly over here. Is Egypt? Egypt. Is this a communist country? Well, usually we say no. Like I say, it's within the Russian sphere of influence, whatever that means. But it fits every one of these. Revolutionary state, an ideological growth oriented.
The one I'm not sure I catch is that growth one. You call it growth.
Oh, they're very good. The big thing for them is to make the output of goods and services grow. And so they concentrate on building basic capital equipment. Now, whether they succeed in doing this or not is another thing.
But it is a standard expectation.
Well, it's more than that. It's a definite orientation of policy toward building steel mills and dams and railroads.
Heavy industry.
Yes, heavy industry. Because that's the way you're going to arrive. And of course, it goes with being non-industrialized and poor. What I'm trying to do with all of this is show you that there aren't any two systems in the world, and that you can divide the countries of the world. You want to say, what kind of economic systems characterize East and West? There's no answer. There are many kinds of economic systems in East and West. The most certain fact is that the economic systems of the world don't fall neatly into our predetermined categories. And we can talk endlessly about the political, ideological, cultural, economic, social differences among these countries. But now, what I want to do, and what this was all preparation for, I'm going to do tomorrow and Thursday, is focus on the techniques of securing cooperation that have evolved in Russia and in the United States since 1920. I'm trying to smudge everything up. I want to destroy some of the our simplistic ways of looking at things. And then turn to the United States and Russia. And to anticipate, what I'm going to argue is that the Russians have been moving in this direction. They have been industrializing, they're less poor. Their political tradition is liberalizing. They've become much less revolutionary. They've become very suspicious of state ownership as a means of production and panacea. They're becoming less ideological, less growth-oriented, and they're developing and using market institutions. In the United States, now, I'm going to run through all of them. Maybe we're not a socialist country. But I'm going to focus down here. I'm going to argue that in the United States, we have moved steadily away from the market organization of economic activity. And I want to suggest why and what some of the consequences of this might be. I'm not going to say that we're becoming poor because of
or that the welfare state is selling out our principles, or that we're losing our freedom and our parliamentary democracy, or anything else. I just want to focus in the United States down here and show how our economic system is being slowly altered by a tendency to depart from the market technique for securing cooperation toward the command technique for securing cooperation. Although when we use the command technique, we don't call it that. We give it other names like social responsibility of industry, things like that.
Like
when
we
make sure
on the
setting
of the steel price.
Yeah, okay. But lots of other things, lots of little things that we aren't really aware of.
And that, the whole point there is you set the dominant price, you set all prices. This is our angle, you know what I mean?
Huh? Well, I don't think.
If you kept the big guy, you can get the little one for that, too. You've got one situation here, just this sort of command angle again. Opening up the copper up here, they have a privately owned property up here, but there's a tremendous possibility not let them develop the mine. We're going to take their property away from them. How can we take their property away from them and still be mine secure and yours secure? Isn't it? I mean, this is the sort of thing you get the big guy.
Well, I don't
know.
Copper,
just for a point of argument, I was wondering how you going to don't be around here, that's all I'm going to do. You're going to repeat this, though, I hope, this summer sometime, perhaps.
If there's a great popular demand.
Well, this market business, it interests me because of one thing that I've got in my craw very heavily, and that is that the way the guy who's got it can keep it is naturally to have the still bigger guy, which is the United States government, ensuring that he can sell his product at a certain price without worrying about any new brother coming up and competing with him. And then we call this protecting the little fellow, and that the Democrats are for the small man, you know.
Yeah, well, we call this humanizing the capitalist system.
Yeah. And it really, now, this is a Norwegian's bothering me terribly, because none of us Norwegians in America had it. You see, when this thing came in, we were just getting it. And all of a sudden, all our guys got socked like mad on all their small businesses, so they couldn't take it away from the big guy. So the Yankee was able to keep it. You see?
Yeah. Well,
it's a real argument.
Well,
that's why we Lutherans are caught in a bind at this moment. We're all in this group, you see. Meanwhile, they're wealthy congregationalists and Presbyterians and Episcopalians. They didn't want to work so hard. They wanted to winter in Bermuda and so on. And all these Michael Norskys come in and buy them off. See, hire them as managers. They did. A lot of them became the managers. Or else, change the government structure so that he can't operate. Take it away from him in taxes before he can reinvest his capital. And then you've frozen him and you have kept yourself secured from this rising Scandinavian tribe. And then we can laugh all the months, but this actually happened.
Well,
I'm not even where I've seen it happen. I mean, this hurt Minnesota. This hurt Wisconsin.
Well, I'm gonna. I don't think you're gonna like what I say, so maybe it's a good thing you're leaving. I'm gonna argue. No, I'm gonna argue that's true, but the big guy. The big guy. The big guys who've got it have secured all sorts of government intervention to protect their privileged position. But little businessmen have been just as active in doing this, and I will argue more active. And that is the little business interest that is really fouling things up.
Yeah, I think it might be right here. I say this because they're not aware of themselves, yeah. They're defeating themselves.
Well, we could probably close on this note. Norwegians of the world, unite. You.
<Your accent. laughs>